Hello, everyone. Welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European Macro Research at Natixis, and with me is Klaus Adam, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim.
Hello, also from my side. So today we would like to talk once more about the reform of the fiscal rules framework in Europe. Intense reform negotiations are currently ongoing between the European Commission and national governments of the European Union. And naturally, the views about which reforms should be undertaken are quite diverse. But today, we'd like to shed light on important aspects of the proposed rule changes. I'm particularly pleased to welcome Olivier Blanchard as a special guest to our podcast today. He will provide us with his views on the reform issues. Olivier needs no introduction, but let me give it nevertheless briefly. He's currently a senior research fellow at the Patterson Institute. And before that, he was for many years chief economist at the IMF, and also for a long time, a professor of economics at MIT in Boston. I should probably add that Olivier is one of the most cited academic economists on the planet. So it's a real pleasure to welcome you here, Olivier. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start with a bird's eye question to not get lost in the details too soon. So why do we need fiscal rules at all in the monetary unions? What are they supposed to achieve in your view?
So I think the argument for rules at a supranational level is based on externalities, which is if a government goes berserk, if debt explodes and then there is debt default, then if you have a highly financially integrated set of countries, then the other countries are going to be in trouble. That's the argument. It's a very strong argument. It's stronger in the Eurozone, but it is basically more general than, you know, being in a monetary union or not. I mean, suppose that the US decided to default or was forced to default, then it would be a catastrophe for the world. We're not in a monetary union with the US, but yet it would have enormous effects. So the argument is, you can do what you want, but if you get into trouble, we'll get into trouble.
Yeah, it's so about protecting the others, I suppose.
Now, let me add something, because I think it's important for our discussion, which is the argument is indeed to prevent debt explosion and debt default in particular countries. But at the same time, fiscal policy is very much the result of a democratic process. And so what rules should do is basically prevent debt explosion. But given that, you know, don't impose anything more on the country than that. The remainder has to be basically the decision of a country, as long as it doesn't put the others in trouble.
Yeah, I just wanted to add or ask more specifically on that. That means only for the extreme outcomes is what fiscal rules are meant to protect against. So they're not meant as fine-tuning, because you said it's just in case a country goes berserk.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to anticipate that it might go berserk. So you don't wait until things are obviously wrong, right? The idea of rules is you basically, it has to be preventive. You have to avoid the possibility of a debt explosion, of irresponsible behavior. So that's the argument for rules. And they come into being even long before there is a debt explosion. Hopefully there is no debt explosion. You can't wait until then. So you're right. That's about it's avoiding a very particular outcome, which has very small probability, but you don't want to wait until you're too close to it.
So the European Commission earlier this year published its proposal for reform of the current set of rules, and the proposals contain two key reform elements. So the first important element, the Commission proposed to move away from a set of common reference values for fiscal adjustment. It proposes instead it can prescribe to individual countries kind of a reference adjustment path that is based on the Commission's debt sustainability analysis. And this reform element has been criticized by fiscally hawkish countries, Germany, for instance, as a way of giving too much discretion to the Commission, which will further increase the political influence on adjustment path. So what do you think about this part of the reform proposal by the EU Commission?
So I think hawkish countries are wrong. Let me be very clear about this. I think what's absolutely essential is that the same methodology is used for all countries. What doesn't follow is that the outcome should be similar, or the recommendation should be similar. Every country is different in very complex ways, and that has to be taken into account. So it's absolutely essential and should not be subject to discretion, is the common methodology. And given this, I think the Commission, let me take an example, which is, you know, we all have kind of principles in how we raise our children, but in the end, we treat them differently. It's not discretion. It's basically that the application of the same general principles, moral principles, do not take the same form depending on whether the kid is okay by itself, or by himself or herself, or indeed needs more attention. So again, I think that the common methodology is not discretion. That's the sense in which I think hawkish countries are wrong. And then the particular common methodology, which is proposed by the European Commission, is, I think, from an economic point of view, the only reasonable one, which is that assessing what's going to happen to debt depends on 100 things, right? It depends on implicit liabilities, you know, the state of your retirement system, whether the budget will have to contribute. It has to do with the nature of government. If it's a coalition government, it has less room to move than a government which has a clear majority, and so on and so on. So I think it's absolutely essential for each country to say what, under the best possible, most likely assumptions, what's going to happen to debt? Is it going to explode? And then in addition, what you have to do is to take into account the fact that we actually don't know everything about the future, right? We don't know what interest rates are going to be. They used to be very low, they are higher now. Will they go low again or not? Growth, you know, is it going to be lower because of the measures we take to fight global warming? Is it not? So you have to take into account the uncertainty, which means that what you need is what we call, you know, in nerdy ways, stochastic debt sustainability analysis, or SDSAs, which is what the Commission is proposing. And again, that's a very clear methodology. The rules by which you construct it must be very clear. But I think that's the only way to do it. You do this, then what you get, you know, in technical terms, is a distribution of debt, say 5 years out, maybe 10 years out, but then we really don't know much. And then you say, what's the probability that debt is really on an exploding path 5 years out? Is it 15%? If it's 15%, we better do something. So 50%, we better do something, right? If it's 2%, 1%, you know, we can take the risk. So it seems to me that from an economic point of view, strictly economic, forgetting political economy, I'm sure you'll come back to this, it is the way to go. And I'm thrilled, actually, that the Commission decided to go that way rather than do adjustments to the existing rules. That's the way to do it. It may not be enough, maybe completed by other aspects of the rules, but I think that's great progress.
Yeah, you've been a long-term advocate of such a stochastic analysis that takes uncertainty into account and looks at it from, certainly from an economic viewpoint, a very sensible approach. Now, the question is, the number one question would be, the Commission hasn't been particularly articulate about what the approach is going to look like. So there are many ways to approach this question of doing a stochastic debt sustainability analysis. And it's very hard to delineate common methodologies that sort of cover the things you probably want to take into account. So how could we come up with consensus on how such an analysis could look like, number one? And two, are you not worried about the political economy aspect? You already alluded to it, and that these things can also be tweaked in the political process in a way that, you know, suits the interests of the time.
So I think the main point is to realize that the complexity doesn't come from the method. It comes from the fact that the world is complex, right? So there's going to be complexity, there's going to be disagreements about assumptions, but I think the methodology is fairly clear. You want to think about what's going to happen to the various elements of spending. You want to look at what's going to happen to revenues under the existing fiscal rules or whatever changes have already been voted or will be voted with high probability. You can look at the retirement system and see when it's going to go into deficits and it will have to be financed one way or the other. So I think we can come, I don't think the methodology is an issue. And having played with it at the IMF, we never went into the degree of detail, which I would like the Commission to do, but it was a very useful exercise, just in making clear what, you know, what's likely to happen to all these components. Now, at the end, there's still going to be disagreement about not the methodology necessarily, but the actual numbers that are used. So I think that it's a very useful discussion. Yeah, I think the discussion part, the construction part of this path is actually an incredibly useful exercise. What I learned at the IMF is you actually have to look at the numbers and say, well, this is going to happen. And somebody says, no, because this is going to happen. That's reality. That's a complexity, right? It is not a question of the method. It's just the way it is. So in the end, indeed, there might be disagreement. So I think that it's very important that the initial exercise come from the national teams, right? The IFIs, as we call them. Because I think it's essential that they say, you know, this is what we think. In a way, they, by doing so, they commit themselves to something, which is if they are too optimistic, then they actually argue for a path that they will not be able to achieve, and they'll be in trouble later. So I think the incentives to actually tell the truth or something close to what you think is the truth is a very good thing. Then the Commission has to look and say, well, there you'll be, you know, you were wrong, let's go back. So there has to be a back and forth. But I think it's absolutely essential that the first step comes from the national teams.
Okay, so then let's have a look at the second element that has been proposed by the Commission, and it's a move away from the deficit indicator, even though that is going to still apply because it's part of the treaty and so on. But it's Commission has proposed to move to something called net primary expenditure. And this is a pure expenditure measure, unlike the deficit number, which takes into account also revenues. It doesn't depend thus on government income. And the net primary expenditure consists of all government expenditures, net of two things. Number one, interest payments, and number two, unemployment insurance costs, which obviously go up during a recession. And it's supposedly a measure that governments can control better than deficits because they don't control on short horizons the income because of business fluctuations and so on. And therefore, the hope is that this is more cyclical and governments can more easily commit to such a measure.
You mean less cyclical, Klaus, I think.
Less cyclical, yeah, I meant to say, sorry. So what do you think of this part of the reform proposal? Is this a welcome change? Would you say that's a good thing to move to net primary expenditure?
Yeah, I think it's a welcome change. I think we have to understand the limits of progress which was made. And before that, the focus was on cyclically adjusted deficit, which implied that one had to have a view about the output gap, which was very hard. So at least that avoids the issue, at least in an explicit way. Now, when you look at the rule, it's clearly progress. I think the notion of excluding interest payments is a very natural one. The issue is net of the changes, the intentional changes in revenues, in effect. And that's much harder. Because there are hundreds of small changes in the laws, in the regulations, which actually have an effect on revenues. So how to compute this part, which is what you take out of spending, is clear when it's a big reform and then you can see what the effect is. But from year to year, there are all kinds of small things which are going to come in, and how the Commission is able to adjust for that is going to be difficult. But yeah, in general, if we're going to have a measure, I think there's a good argument for having, you know, one number that one can look at, because the SDSA, as I talked about, is the complex object. You can't look at everything all the time. So having some measure which you've committed to and you can measure fairly easily, not perfectly, I think is a very good idea. So I endorse that aspect just as much.
So perhaps not surprisingly, these proposals by the Commission have not met, say, the similar kind of applause in all the countries. It has been criticized by some of the countries, others welcome it. In your view, what explains that different countries in the euro area have so different opinions of what constitutes good fiscal rule? Is that just a different fiscal starting point, or are there more fundamental differences between countries in the assessment, what role should fiscal policy play, is it the different dogmas which have just prevailed over centuries?
Understand both sides. It seems to me that the DSA is a fuzzy object by nature, and so you worry that it's going to be manipulated in various ways. And we know that there's a deficit bias, that governments naturally in many countries have a tendency to accept deficits in order not to have to increase taxes now. So I perfectly understand that side and the desire to have a hard number, some hard number, a decrease in debt by some amount every year, something like this. It's a very natural position. On the other side, I also understand the position of other countries, which say, well, the hard number goes against the spirit of the reform of the rules, which is that, a stochastic DSA shows how complex things are, and basically kind of committing to a specific number, it can be very dangerous, and it can come it can actually affect output and activity and unemployment. And so we should try very much not to commit too hard a number. My sense is that the issue is not so much about the hard number. I think it's important to have some hard number, which is a reference. It's the nature of a hard number. And that's where I see a difference, which is, again, let's go back to the first question you asked, which is the purpose of these rules is to avoid debt explosion. That's not the same thing as saying the purpose of these rules is to decrease the debt to GDP ratio. There's a difference between the two. Right? I mean, Germany, for example, wants to avoid a debt explosion and has done it very nicely and wants to decrease its debt to GDP to low levels, which is fine as well. Okay, but other countries may decide that they are not taking a risk, that debt explosion is not a highly likely outcome, but they don't feel the same need to decrease debt to GDP the way Germany does. Different approaches, and that's, from an economic point of view, perfectly acceptable. So what worries me about the hard number is that it hardwires a decrease in the debt to GDP ratio of 0.5% per year, and that, it seems to me, is a very dangerous thing to do. Again, you can avoid debt explosion without it, but that goes much further. And the problem with it is, first, some countries may not want to do it, and some countries may, if they do it, may get into trouble in other ways. I mean, if you have a very weak economy, you may actually want to defer a decrease in debt to later. If you want to take the right measures against global warming, for example, which implies probably a lot of public green investment, then you may not be able to raise taxes at the same time for political reasons, and you may decide that a bit more debt, or at least maintaining the same debt to GDP ratio rather than decreasing it, is a way to achieve both. You can take the measures to fight global warming, and yes, you leave a bit more debt than would otherwise be the case to future generations, but they may, they may actually enjoy a better planet, even if there's a bit more debt. So I understand both sides. I think it's important to have some hard number. The question is which one? And again, I disagree fairly strongly with the notion that it has to be a steady decrease in the debt to GDP ratio.
Right. So now we had a formidable debate about what fiscal rules should look like, but one issue in Europe in the past and likely also in the future is going to be how we're going to enforce any rule that has been really agreed upon. And the record for the past doesn't look all too good. We had two debt defaults already in the European Union, one in the Eurozone and one outside. But in the past, we had also seen a certain amount of hysteresis, if I may say so, in debt dynamics in a number of key countries, in particularly France and Italy. Debt ratios have tended to shoot up during difficult times, which is fine, I think, during the financial crisis, also during the COVID pandemic, but then failed to come down sufficiently during the more tranquil times that followed. We haven't seen yet much following the COVID, but probably it's going to be difficult to get this down again. So this ratcheting up effect of the debt ratios, would you think this is a problem? And, you know, and number two, how could enforcement of any rule we managed to, you know, agree on in the European Union be strengthened or better implemented?
So that goes back to, again, the first question, which is why there should be EU rules. I mean, if governments behave perfectly, would be no need. They would try to avoid debt explosion at all costs, and everything would be fine. So there is no question that in a number of countries, there is a deficit bias, that basically you increase spending and you don't decrease it later, and then you get into a higher level of debt. So there is no question that the issue is there, and that's the reason you need EU rules. Again, if all countries were like Germany, there will be no need for EU rules, right? There seems to be no deficit bias. We can go into why, but it's the case. So it's only because there is deficit bias that there is a need for EU rules. Now, but enforcement, I mean, the notion of fines is a joke. You know, no country is going to write a check, especially if they're in trouble already from the point of view of debt. But there are all kinds of ways in which the EU Commission can basically punish countries which do not behave. We've seen it with respect not to debt, but with respect to law and order. We've seen, you know, what has happened to Orban and people like this when they do things which are not consistent with the principles of the European Union. And you can basically just, you know, exclude them some programs. Or to take another example, Italy at this stage is behaving rather well in terms of in fiscal terms. Now, it may be because Madame Meloni actually is fiscally responsible, but almost surely part of the reason is that that's a precondition for receiving EU funds, you know, the next generation funds. And so for a number of years, I think that Italy will behave. It may be deeper than that. Maybe, you know, even populist governments have become more fiscally responsible. I think that's the case. But there are counts, there are sticks. It's just not fines. But exclusion from some programs surely can work.
And what role do you think should financial markets play in that? I mean, looking at Italy, my guess would be as well that Meloni is behaving the way she is because she learned the 2018 lesson from Salvini and Di Maio that if you go against, say, the rules too obviously, well, the markets will not play along. And there was this almost failure of this retail BTP bond. So I think financial markets in the past have played a role. Do you think that should be strengthened or?
No, that's the role of the EU Commission and financial markets, the respective roles, is a crucial issue. So there are some people who say there's really no need for EU rules because financial markets will do the job. But we know that financial markets do the job, but not perfectly, that sometimes they just get crazy for reasons which are not totally convincing. So they do a good job, but they don't do a perfect job. And that's why I think that the interaction between this new process that the Commission is suggesting or pushing and the financial markets can be important. I think financial markets are very much trying to do financial markets. Rating agencies and people affected by the recommendations of the rating agencies try to do a job which is very similar to the job that the Commission is going to take if these reforms go through, which is that they basically do an SDSA. They do a stochastic debt sustainability analysis. If you read the analysis of a country, it's based on what they think is going to happen. So they try to do the job. And I think what's going to happen if these rules are put in place is that the Commission will help enormously. The national authorities and the Commission will help enormously in clarifying what they see the future as. And they'll indicate that they think it's okay or that they have to do something at some margin. So I think it will improve the work of rating agencies and by implication will probably improve the efficacy of the financial market reactions. So I see this as complements rather than substitutes.
So let's think a little bit about the worst case. In the end, the stochastic debt sustainability analysis is a stochastic analysis, and there could always things happen that drive governments with some probability into a default region or close to it. So do you think that truly a government debt default of a significant country, and say a big country, not like Greece, which was a relatively small part of the Eurozone, is really conceivable in the monetary union? Do you think that's a thing that could happen, or should it not be happen? Would that be counterproductive? Should one take it off the table ex ante or only ex post? How do you see this?
So I think unambiguously it would be a catastrophe if one of the big EU countries went into default. So I think we have to avoid it at all cost. And again, this is a set of preventive measures. It's not going to happen overnight, so we have time. But I think the notion that this could be, in some circumstances, the right outcome, I think is wrong. Can I think of events which would trigger it? Almost surely World War III, things like this, in times of war, actual war, anything is possible, and maybe it's better than the alternative. But short of something like that, no, avoid it at all cost.
Very good. Then I'll try a quick summary of what you said for our listeners. So why do we need fiscal rules? Because of externalities. They make rules necessary, in particular in the monetary union. But as you said, let's take a look at the US. If the US were to default, that would have immense implications for everyone. So fiscal policy has externalities. Hence, we need rules. The European Commission proposal, is it too much discretion for the EU Commission? What part of these proposals? You said that essentially is that it's the same methods for all countries, but that doesn't mean that the outcome should be the same. And you made the example of raising kids where same rules in principle apply, but how they then applied in reality differs because the kids differ. The net primary expenditure at the center of the assessment, is that a good idea? You think it's a good change because the old ones had too much focus of cyclically adjusted fiscal position and that made it necessary to talk about the output gap, lots of uncertainty there. And revenues, assessing what revenues will do is also complicated. So this is, you think, a step forward or in the right direction. Why do have different countries different views on fiscal policy? So it's understandable why some countries are skeptical because the deficit bias, I think you said, is a well-known historical fact. But committing to just one hard number is problematic. It makes a complex reality too simplistic and risks that a lot of important details get lost here. The goal should not to have a steady decrease in debt necessarily. The goal is to prevent debt explosion, and that is something two different things. Enforcement of those fiscal rules. You think that the recent history has shown that indeed the European Commission has the means to enforce rules, looking at Hungary. For example, making sure that some countries do not participate in programs is a powerful tool. Financial markets do have to play a role here and did in the past. You think actually that the stochastic debt analysis could enhance that function and make it maybe easier for rating agencies and in turn for markets to play their role. Government default of a big country, you think that would be a catastrophe and should be avoided at more or less all costs outside of very extreme scenarios. Was it a fair summary of what you said?
You've done an amazing job. You should have done the interview. Thank you.
Well, then, thank you very much for your time today, Olivier. It was a great pleasure, and I certainly learned a lot, and I'm sure all our listeners did.
Thank you.
Thank you, Olivier. Bye.